in the, our agenda in the next hour and a half, ideally, is to finish this Makara set. And to do that, we're going to have to do shir somewhat less participatorily than we have done to date. And there'll be the Chazara shir afterwards, which can fill in things I missed or if we didn't get to cover everything all the way up. So I want to start reviewing the Rimigash. And the Rimigash, as best I can tell, introduces the notion of benefit to consumers as an overriding consideration. Whatever rights people have to limit competition don't apply in a context when there is a benefit to Jewish consumers. Introduces it, so far as I can tell, and he doesn't say it otherwise, entirely from his mind. And if he looks at the Gemara and says, "Hey, that wouldn't make any sense," and says, "Okay, it must apply only in that case." So now we're going to move to the Miki Yosef. Miki Yosef says a number of things that have interest to us. We're going to start, for continuity's sake, we're going to start with the last one, which is at the very bottom of the Miki Yosef, when he says, "Perish Hari ben Migash," etc. And he says, so he quotes Rimigash as saying, "The Hainu, that right, Shirchu Taichu, the Hainu, Dafka." Right, he says all this applies only when they do not diminish the market price excessively. Right, then we can say if the external people who have arrived in town to sell their goods are only diminishing prices somewhat, then there's still a right of limitation. I will mostly tvei, but if the prices will diminish dramatically as a result of the allowing the exterior people to sell, ha'ikat takanas lochim dehayim masa im nisraelenu lo masim akve. Right. So his first thing is right. It's sort of the inverse. Right. What we saw in the Rimigash, and this is not, so far as I can tell, this is not the Rimigash we have, which I think is pieced together with one major manuscript. I'm not sure, but I don't think we have multiple witnesses to the Rimigash. But I think what he says is that the Rimigash the Rimigash says that even where the Gemara says explicitly there is a right of exclusion. The right of exclusion only applies when the external people won't drop prices too much. So the Rimigash we saw didn't seem to distinguish between too much or at all. Right? But he says, not too much. And he goes on to say, V'niradas ravzal bezul gadol, aval lohozil ma'at yosri mocher ir vade matzum akve. Right? So what he does is, as far as I can see, is he offers a counter svara to the Rimigash svara. Right? Nothing here is in the text. And if the text says either you have a right to exclude people, you don't have a right to exclude people. The Rimigash says, well, whenever it says you have a right to exclude people, that's only if you will not thereby be depriving a Jewish customer base of benefit. The Megiosa comes along and says, but that's only if you will deprive the customer base of a serious benefit. The Jewish customer base of a serious benefit. But if it's a minor benefit, then no big deal. And he adds, right, and he adds in a practical claim, which is a wholly new phenomenon to think, right, really very, very practical economics. He says, "Lokain," because if you wouldn't limit the Rimigash's principle in that way, "Li'olam lo matzu me'akve," you would never be able to, right, the whole notion of restricting competition would never work. "She'i efshar she'kishyesham harbe b'nei umanut lo yuzal hashar lo yuzal hashar." All right, what he says is that competition naturally lowers prices.
This is like on topic.
I want to hold this though, right? So I'm going to set up. My reading of the Miki Yosef is, competition naturally lowers prices. So, if you were to say that any lowering of prices would override a right to keep out competition, you would gut the law. There would be no case in which you could keep out competition. So he has to offer, right? So he offers a distinction. And the distinction he offers, right, in the formal outcome terms is between minor price changes and major price changes. Now that, unfortunately, is a very vague category. What is the difference between a minor price change and a major price change? There's a second way of reading him, which is focused not on the outcome, but on the mechanism. We could say the difference it offers is that you cannot keep out, right, you can keep out competition if the prices, the lower prices that will result are the natural result of competition. But if the external people are willing to, right, are willing to undercut the market for whatever reason, right, and sell below their natural, right, below their natural cost, right, then, right, because of the benefit to consumers, right, this is a windfall. And so you're willing to allow customers a windfall if the external competitors are deliberately undercutting the market. There is a third model in which you could say that no, that's way too extreme. A third model is to say that we allow you cannot keep out competitors if they have the same cost structure as you do, and so the competition will be fair. But you can keep out. You can't keep out competitors if, sorry, the other way around. You can keep out competitors. You can keep out competitors if ultimately what's going on is normal economic competition. But if really what you're trying to do is engage in protectionism, right, but there are outside merchants who, right, who would be the economic benefit of the community simply to allow them to be the suppliers because they produce, right, they have much cheaper costs, so then you're not allowed to do that. Right, you can't maintain a wall around to keep out lower price competitors. Right, you can keep out competition, which is fundamentally in the same economic ballpark as you are, but you cannot, right, but you can't erect tariff walls to keep out, right, to keep people from bringing in products that were outside, right, with that were made by child laborers in sweatshops in Thailand, or whatever it may be. Right, unless you happen to think that, you know, that there are moral issues involved. I used to keep on my wall a wonderful Dilbert comic, in which Dogbert, I think, has decided to make sneakers to enslave Elbonians to in his basement to produce sneakers, and Dilbert is feeling very morally queasy about this, and one of the Elbonians comes out and says, "Help us, Mister! Your dog is keeping us prisoner in your basement." And Dilbert takes out his mace and sprays him and walks back and says, "Well, you know, I like morality, but I also like cheap sneakers." and walks away. So you might think that there are, right, that there are boundaries to the extent of it, but on the fundamental question, you could read the Namuke Yosef as saying that distinction. So I'm going to offer three readings of the Namuke Yosef. One is it's purely a quantitative thing. How much do the people save? And we have to figure out what, right, how can you concretize that, right, that quality? Is it percentage? Is it raw amount? Is it luxury goods as opposed to staples? Things like that. Second possibility, which I think is the which I'm offering now as the intermediate possibility, is that you can keep out competitors who have the same cost structure as you, but you can't keep out competitors who genuinely offer the opportunity to change the economic structure of the transaction because their costs are lower, and therefore they can sell at much lower prices. And the third possibility is that what you can't keep out is competitors who offer you windfalls because they're willing to sell beneath the market, particularly in the case he's talking about where you have people who are trapped in your city, and they have merchandise, and they have to get rid of it, and they're stuck here, they can't leave, so their figs are going to spoil. So they offer to sell radically underneath the normal cost structure. So you can't keep them out because that's a windfall for consumers. Okay, now it'll take...
Can't or you can?
You can't. The bigger the benefit for consumers, the less you can keep them out.
It's the opposite of a lot of what we've been reading. So
the second and third are almost the same.
Yes, it's just a question of what the... Right, I'm just offering two, right? You could combine them and say they're both true. Right? And you can say it's counterintuitive because you're... But the challenge is that the greater the competition, the more advantages the competition has, the less you can keep them out. Mm-hmm. Right? Because our ultimate loyalty is to consumers. Okay. Fine. Three comments. Josh, Avi, Elliot.
Okay. So my comment is that the Ri Megas, he didn't have an economic theory. He only had a public policy theory. He said if for some reason the prices were to change, then we would implement these, we the Rabbanan, would implement these policies. Though I do believe in, that he has three actors. He has the Lokhim, the Mochrim, and the rabbis who look at the situation and enact public policies. But he has no theory as to why the prices would go up or down.
He doesn't offer one.
Right.
Yes, doesn't mean he doesn't have one.
The Nimuke Yosef says, has an economic theory. He says it's impossible that supply could increase
yes.
and the price would not go down.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Nimuke Yosef provides an economic theory and then offers a different halakha on the basis of his economic theory.
That's right. That's correct. I just don't know if the Nimuke Yosef didn't have it or just right, or just didn't write it.
You mean the Rimagash?
Rimagash, yeah, I don't.
Well, what he's writing is so agnostic as to how, towards any like theory of economics.
Okay, I'm agnostic about whether he's agnostic. Yes, Avi.
Your way of explaining it in terms of cost structures, although it seems like a good conceptual way to put in place this rule, why is there not the hook in the Lashon of the Nimuke Yosef?
The hook?
He doesn't say that at all.
Sure, he doesn't say
simply, it. Normal competition creates lower prices. That doesn't apply here. Only a large price difference applies here. He says nothing about how that price difference comes into being, so long as it is not through normal competition.
That's right. But you'll note that the Rimagash put something in Misvara, and the Nimuke Yosef put something in Misvara that countered the Rimagash Svara, mm-hmm. right, that balanced it. And so I'm putting in something in that balances the Nimuke Yosef Svara, balancing the Rimagash Svara. And I don't think that's illegitimate.
Okay, so but it's like in the realm of Svara, not in the realm of like Shah Shah Nam.
There's nothing in his language that demonstrates that there should be a limitation that should be anything more than quantitative, or at least more than the economic theory that it's just normal competition versus abnormal competition. But if you think he's making a fundamental public policy argument, so then you can say, well, you know what, maybe he didn't think of that distinction when he was writing, but if you raise the question to him, mm-hmm. he would have said, oh yeah, of course, I wouldn't apply it in that case.
Why wouldn't he say... No, that's actually, like, maybe he would say that that's considered normal competition, that somebody else, somebody going out and finding ways to increase their economies of scale, somebody inventing a new technology, somebody coming in with...
So you should be able to keep them out, even though there's a large price difference.
Perhaps.
Okay.
Like, that's why it's the hook, is that he might say, no, that's normal competition, that's right. keeping you out.
He might, and he might not. That's what I want, right? All I'm pointing out is that he might and might not, mm-hmm. and once he's making a public policy argument based on economic principles... So that I'm entitled to say, well, you know what? Let's take logically his argument shouldn't apply to there, or his argument might apply here. I don't think you can. I wouldn't want to take him as making a flat, you know, absolute, you know, mechanical rule that applies even when his purposes aren't achieved, because he's just saying something misvara.
Okay.
Right. That's my. But I don't in any way claim that I can. Right. The only data points I have is little big. Right. Result of natural competition with no external factors mentioned. And somehow something which does not seem to be the result of the same kind of normal competition. And then I said, oh, look, there are two ways that can happen. One can happen is if your cost structure is lower. The other can happen is if your incentives to sell are increased or your options for selling are decreased. So you could say it's all of those, or you could say Misvara, right? Maybe he's only talking about one of those. In the specific case, it's better to make the argument it's easy to say that the case he's talking about is a case where there are people from outside who are trapped. So he's talking about windfalls, and he wouldn't apply it to the cases where the cost structure was different. All right, or you might say that all that matters is the end. All right, I'm open to all of those.
Okay.
What he does to make me happy is he says, look, it depends on economic theory. And I'm trying to maximize this, right? And I have a certain goal I'm trying to achieve, and I maximize it. Now we have to figure out what his goal is. Okay, Elliot.
So going with economic theory, this idea of windfalls and that being a way to read it,
yeah.
Does that not lead to this idea of, to this ability to do predatory pricing? That, like, I'm a Walmart and I have such cheaper prices and I'm willing to undersell, but I'm willing to undersell to kick all these local people out of
business. Right, so you have to know the difference, because predatory pricing is not in the long run a benefit for consumers. Predatory pricing is like an advance, a cash advance that you'll have to pay for it.
Okay, but if some foreigner is coming in and offering much cheaper prices,
so we as rabbis have to be sophisticated, and we have to know, right? Are they engaging in predatory pricing because they want all the domestic auto manufacturers to go out of business so they can sell all the cars in the United States in the next 30 years, Or is it that they overproduced and they got to get rid of these cars?
How would you do it?
Well, that's what the economists are coming in to tell us.
Okay.
Right? That's what they're, that's part of what they're, right? The whole work is to see, is there a model that, if, because the case that they're working on is, right, then may or may not end up being the truth, is exactly this case. A Walmart walks into a community and offers prices much lower than all the local community businesses. Right? So, right? And if a Beit Din were to decide that we had an interest in preserving the local businesses, if the Walmart is engaged in predatory pricing, and we have to think of Walmart, right? The issue is comes up often in, right, which is why I gave them this case in Hashgachot. Right, what happens if, right, what happens, let's say in Boston, right? We have sure Stop and Shops bakeries. What does that do to all the local small kosher bakeries? In Chicago, it was Jewel Osco opening a kosher meat section, which was going to significantly diminish the business of Romanian. Right, so this is probably the most common issue that comes up of the sort, and that's exactly the issue. Is there a mechanism for distinguishing predatory pricing from non-predatory pricing that would be accessible to a Beit Din? Okay, I want to go through a few more things, and I'll take comments again because now the question I want to ask about all these positions is, it's very nice to say you can keep them out unless they offer a significantly lower price. What happens if the local sellers offer to match the price then? Is it a one-stop move? Right, you each, right, yours are market, they undercut the market they're in, and now you just have to compete? Or can we say, look, you know what? You're letting, right, can the local merchants come and say, look, you're letting them in at a lower price, so we'll match the price, now keep them out. Of course, they could cut further. Right, so is Beit Din just supposed to stand there with them and watch them bargain, and, right, and in the end, we keep them out unless there's a point at which they go so low that the local merchants are unwilling to match? Or is it that we assume the local merchants had their chance, and the external merchants get to make their offer, and that's how we make the decision? And again, to realize again that, you know, that we have here, Beit Din is functioning as a presumptive regulatory body that all business in the city runs through, and they have the right to issue commercial licenses or not. So the question is what the best regulatory strategy for Beit Din under those circumstances are, and you could have fun game theory things, whether it's better to make people to try and get people to make their one best offer, or whether you'll get a better result if you engage in iterative bargaining processes. You have the question. You have the question of efficiency. You have the question of the tendency to corruption. Because if you're going to, right, because if it's going to be an iterative process, so then people are going to try and find out what the other person's price is. They'll try and pay the other person to not lower the bids below at a certain point. So there are lots of administrative challenges that come up, right, in terms of how Beit Din is supposed to figure this out. And I don't think the Harim Migash or the Nukei Yosef tell us what the administrative strategy is for regulating this market. Okay, I'll take two comments. Oh, wait.
I'll say the principle is Takanas Lakeland, and being that we care about this to the buyers, so allowing other people into the market is essentially a price ceiling, and we don't institute a price floor. So we want to make sure that the price does not get too expensive. So there's nothing in the Reed Magash that says that he would step in if things get too low.
No, the price floor. But I'm saying, but the question is, does he offer, if the outside merchants offer a lower price initially, does he offer the local merchants a chance to match and still have a monopoly or not?
I think it's natural. Naturally, they would see that this guy's selling and they would just
be... Yes, but when they lower prices, will we now kick the other people out and say you're not offering a service anymore? Because, right, thank you very much, you lowered the market, but now they've promised that they'll lower their profit margin also, so you can leave again.
I think at that point you say that we want to make sure that it gets its chavis paid back.
Okay, you think so? I don't know, right? That depends on what my interests are. Yes, Shannon.
I'm just wondering if, like, when you're thinking about what's best for the consumer, there's like no end to how far you can be thinking. Like, you,
are we only thinking economically? Are we? I mean, the Walmart, if they stick around, they still probably are going to have pretty low prices. They can hike it up once the local business goes out, but they're still going to keep it relatively low because that's what Walmart does, right? So you say, okay, that's pretty good for consumers. They're going to have more access to a wider number of goods and lower prices for, like, the long haul. Or do we say, you know what, like, yeah, the local bakery was more expensive, but, like, we really enjoyed having, like, the creativity of a local business. Or, like, you know, everyone loves an indie bookstore. Like, at one point, is it only economic? Are we thinking
so about this is a great question. So that's exactly leads to the next point, where the Milkiyos and Rima Gapsh say, oh, but of course if there's a difference in quality, then everything goes out the window. Now, the problem is, unless you're dealing with absolute commodities, right, so it's very, right, so it's very hard, right, to deal with commensurability, and right, what about selection, right? What if you're offering wider? So, what I want to, I guess the broad theory I would set out here is that you can't get the law from the halacha,
right?
Because there's so many factors left, right? We're trying, right? There's such a gap between the space that the halacha covers and the reality that we have to deal with. This is an oversimplified economic model. Maybe it was true in their case, but In our case, there are always going to be confounding factors, and so, in essence, I think we have to construct the halacha, and the question is how to construct the halacha authentically. And as I said, we haven't even begun to address the fundamental question, which is that almost all businesses now are corporations, and corporations are not. And what defines a corporation as local or external? Right. Shareholders, workers. Circle of business. Does it depend whether it's a privately held corporation or a publicly held corporation? Where its headquarters are. All right. These are all issues that we have. We haven't, I think, begun to seriously address. And I think right. And so I think the Milkei Yosef is a nice step forward because he explicitly says, "Guess what? This depends on an economic theory," but. As with, crudely, as with science, right? What happens if somebody pegs a halacha to a scientific theory that we have much more, right, that we have, much more advanced knowledge about? So does that apply to economics as well? I think that's a fair question. Okay, I want to make a couple more points. Sorry, I have to rush through. But I make a couple, so probably people spoke, unless everyone else has used up, you get, from now on, you probably assume that I'm going to go around the room for comments if you spoke once instead of letting the same people talk every time. Okay, so then other points I just wanted to make in the Milkei Yosef. One is at the very beginning when he talks about fish. So he has some language that sounds exactly like Rashi, like it sounds like Bali Ado or not Bali Ado, but he also has an interesting line. This is the if you look at the paragraph meaning mihu, so he says, mihu. Mihu is still in the Milkei Yosef. Hainu dafka ki hai gavna, sh'adayin lo higia liyad echad mehem davar. This rule of by the chanut applies only if neither of them has yet gotten anything. And now he formulates a general rule, really the first general rule we have seen in the sugya of the sort. It says, sh'kol mi sh'kadam be'eza inyan, the karov hadavar lahagio, eino rashai lachaviro lahakdim blit lo mimenu. So there's a tension in the Milkei Yosef, because on one hand his language is like Rashi, which seems to say that we require certainty, and maybe even require it to be actual theft. He actually constructs the fish case in this fascinating way, where the fish have, it's not because the fish won't go to his mitsuda and instead go to yours, it's because there's a possibility that the fish was in his mitsuda and then swam over to yours. So when he constructs the case, it sounds like it absolutely has to be something very much approaching Gezel. When he formulates the rule, he formulates it in the broadest principle, and he formulates it in a way, obviously, which I think is very hard not to believe, that he is thinking, Ani Amahapech Becharara. Right? Anyone who has priority in a certain matter and is about to achieve it. Right? So I wanted to call out that language of Milkei Yosef and decide whether you want to take the limiting framework that it has to be plausibly like Gezel, has to be in the realm of Gezel so that you can just sort of extend it and say, well, it was about to happen, so it happened. Or is he making a broad moral principle that it's not nice to jump ahead in line? Okay, the other point I wanted to make to Yosef is if you look at his formulation of Rav Huna, so he says, right, we're in the paragraph below this now, he says, Rav Huna, de amar le'el, de varmasa, varmasa matzim akev. Now, in my text of Rav Huna, he said nothing about a varmasa, varmasa, he said about a, he was talking about a varmavoy, so maybe it's the wrong Rav Huna. That's why I wanted to point it out, if he said it or not. Okay. So much for the Nemukhi Yosef. Moving on.
Wait,
to the,
yes. We don't think he's expanding Rav Huna's role.
So which Rav Huna is Modeh B'Rochlin?
Not Rav Huna Rei Rishon, but Rav Huna.
No. So in the Gemara, which Rav Huna is Modeh by Rochlin, which Rav Huna is Modeh by
Rav Huna by Yosef is Modeh B'Rochlin, and Rav Huna is Modeh by teachers.
Rav Huna is motivated by teachers. So the context of the Gemara that he cites it in should be Rav Huna Breder of Yosef. On the other hand, if he says Rav Huna. So I have to work it out.
That could just be a typo.
Could just be a typo. That's, as I said, right? When you have two people of the same name in the same sugya saying similar things, it's not reliable. But again, the problem is, you know, it could be a typo, but the question is, did he realize that he had a typo? Maybe he's working with a text that has, you know, we think is a typo. So I just wanted to put it out so you're aware of it. Okay, in the Aguda. The Aguda says we're on the third line of the Aguda. V'itzur v'mirabanan afilu l'akvui, that's our line. So v'sefer avi asaf, which is the ravya, nireh. V'itzur v'mirabanan kofin b'nei ha'ir l'hatir lo yishuv. Okay, so it sounds like when it says afilu l'akvui, that means that we can compel the citizens of a town to permit him to dwell there. Right, so this is a whole new, it changes the framework from a commercial, the question is, can he commercially set up a business in a fixed location, to can you compel them to grant him citizenship?
Right, you're saying
so, the yeshuv. Is to grant him the right to live here. It's not about the, right, so he translates l'akvuye, not to set up a fixed store location, right? So we talk about the difference between l'hadure and l'akvuye. So we read it as circulate through the city or have a storefront, and he reads it as circulate from city to city, or set up a location or live in this city. And he says that the outcome of this is that you right that we paskin that it's sort of, that. If a Tzurva Merabanan wishes to live in town, so then they, right, even if he has a business which may compete with existing businesses, you have to let him into the city. One sec, okay. Then you have the next line, which is hard to read partially because there are textual corruptions. So the editor of this text, the text said V'yesh Lomar. But which seems to be making a point. In addition, the editor changes to D'yesh Lomar, right, where this is a rationale for the previous line about Tzurva Merabanan. Okay, then you have the next word, which we have the text has Lida, but I assume is, or I would argue, is a typo for Dilo. Right, the Dal and the Lamed got flipped. Right, so it's either V or D'yesh Lomar. Delo gazru kadmonim delo kihilchasa. V'ein rishayin b'nei ha'ir la'asiel kitzasan l'gabe. So the problem is, what? Right, what does it mean that lo gazru kadmonim delo kihilchasa? Right, how does that explain? How does that explain anything? Right, what we have in the Gemara is that, right, in fact, right, Ravina did allow somebody to do something delo kihilchasa. So he's clearly explaining that line in some way. But he seems to be reversing it.
So why can't it be Lada? It makes sense if you say Lada.
Pardon?
It makes sense if you say Lada. Lada, for this case, for the case of Tzur Merabanan, they won't go to Shul Kel Chosah.
Okay. Okay, so you want to read it as Lada. It really is. So what is the Yesh Lomar? Because you can say that for such a case, the Kadmonim, right, where gozer shelo kilchasa, which is a fascinating phrase. Right, they made a law against the law. And ve'ein rashan ve'ein ha'ir la'siel kitzasan ligabe.
And though normally, right, it seems to be like normally, the normally we treat any, we have defined political units, and those defined political units are, in terms of citizenship, are defined political units are function democratically. It means that a majority can make decrees. Can make decrees about some of them. And he says, but the majority of this town is not allowed to make decrees regarding him. And so maybe what he's saying is, normally the loki hilchasa means that normally the halacha is that any defined political unit can do whatever it wants, right, regarding outsiders. And so we override the normal democratic principles of self-governance. Could be. Yes, yeah.
Just coming back to your Yishuv thing, people already talk about, I mean, the Braita is Losh, that people are, that a Chaya wants to be Hoshiv in a rule. Why is that? Are we assuming that that's settled there, or open up shop there? I thought that was open up shop there.
Well, the Hoshiv is to rent to him so he can open up shop.
I mean, so why not Yishuv? So he'll settle there so he can open up shop.
Yeah, but I think that Lahatir Yishuv is to allow him to settle there.
I don't get your greater point.
Because I thought
the reason that he's settling there is because
I think it means settle in the city, as opposed to, of course he's in the city. Can he find a fixed geographic location to sell from? Right. The way I've been reading up till now is the difference between Rochlim and what Tzurvim Rabbanan do is that Rochlim have to wander through the city hawking, and Tzurvim Rabbanan can rent a storefront. And what he says no is Rochlim can be in the city for a set period of time, and then they have to wander on to another city. But a Tzurvim Rabbanan can become a citizen of the city, permanent citizen of the city, and open up shop. When he opens up shop, we don't care whether he wanders or he has a storefront.
I thought that the Rochlim could just wander indefinitely and so just not open up shop.
So now we have to try and figure out what is the boundary, right? You know, when you say you can be an itinerant merchant, but you can't set up shop. So can I be a permanent itinerant merchant? Right, how do we? Right, that is a regulatory question. Right, sorry, as opposed to legally, we'll say is you can't. Right, we'll say is we won't give you a residence permit. And it might be that it's just that we'll assume that it's not economically viable for somebody who doesn't, or we might say, you know what, as long as we don't give you a residence permit, at some point you're going to want to have a home. Right, and it won't be here. Right, I see that as an administrative challenge, right? The goal is we don't want outsiders to be able to move in here permanently economically. Mm-hmm. And how we set up that regulation, we can do in like, we could say, you know what, you can sell it permanently, but we do it like parking meters. We don't allow outsiders to rent hotel rooms for more than 2 weeks. Right? There are lots of ways in which we can discriminate against outsiders if we want to. Okay. Yes, Janet.
I feel like when we're talking about students, we're already there. I don't think he's really making chidush here, because if the point of why we're letting students open up a standing shop is so that they won't interrupt their learning, then you're expecting them to stay there for a significant period of time, versus a peddler that's like an especially wealthy peddler and wants to rent a storefront for like the day of the shuk, or come in for a month and then leave and wants a standing place, right? That's not what we're talking about with a student if we're trying to let him learn somewhere for a significant amount of time.
So you think that his reading of the Gemara is compelling, and that was just wrong to begin with?
I hadn't thought of it in that much detail before, but I don't think he's...
Okay.
I think he's in line with what the Gemara is.
I'm willing to say that he's a compelling read until we find somebody who explicitly says the other way around. We have to try and figure it out. Okay, the last thing that the Aguda says, which will come later on, is that, as always, whenever you have discussions about commerce in the Gemara, when you get to the Middle Ages, Jews only have one business, really, which is money lending. So the question, becomes, how do laws which mostly apply, seem to have been applied to the sale of tangible goods, right? How do we extend them to banking? And so he extends this law about tangible goods to banking. Rashi has the interesting case where Rashi thinks that what it is you have people who have outstanding loans in the town, and meanwhile they sell tangible goods. But that seems sort of interesting. Like, why would people make their money by loans? Why do they have tangible goods to sell at all?
So you have to try and figure out what Rashi's reality is. But this is going to be a real challenge all the way through, is that the Gemara is dealing with an economy which the they still seem to fundamentally believe, think that we're not charging interest to fellow Jews. And the economy is fundamentally internally Jewish. We control the entire economy. And that's the halacha as it plays out. When you get to the Middle Ages, we're dealing with a big part of the economy is lending money to non-Jews, and that's where the competition is about, not about an intra-Jewish thing. You begin to see that the Rimi Gash, who distinguishes between whether the buyers are Jewish or not. Right? That doesn't show up in the Gemara. Right? The Gemara is dealing with a completely internal economy. So, right, and then now we get to the United States. Right, so you have three models. Right, to start with, you have an economy which is internally Jewish. You have an economy which is mixed Jewish, non-Jewish, but it's very clear that you have interest only in the Jewish part of the economy. And then you have the possibility in the United States that we actually see ourselves as part of a mixed economy. And maybe we're supposed to be concerned with, maybe Dir Shuat Shlomair means that you're supposed to be concerned with the economic benefit of the city in which you are in, regardless of whether it's Jewish or not Jewish.
Don't most people who work deal with the mixed economy? I mean, maybe in some parts of the United States, people would deal with only internally Jewish economy.
Yeah, but we might still say, even if we're dealing with a mixed economy, we might say that the halakhic interest is only in the Jewish part of the economy. Right? And that's what they do in the Middle Ages, right? They have a mixed economy, but they will just say, we disregard the interests of the non-Jews. Right? That's what Rimi Gash said. We might say in the United States that we don't think that at all. We think that it's immoral.
I just don't see how that's physically possible. Okay.
To only care about the interests of the Jews?
The Jewish landlord.
Thank you.
I have a Jewish-owned butcher store, and Walmart wants to come in and is willing to undercut him.
Okay.
Right? Okay, that's the
Pramachma. Isn't the majority of the Jewish economy these days even further removed from the sale of goods than money lending is?
I don't even know. Again, outside of Kashrut, I don't know what a Jewish economy would be now. It's Kashrut and Days Falls. Pardon?
I was thinking about the diamond.
Yeah, I'm just saying, and also the computer store.
Diamonds is an interesting thing, I guess.
Like landlords, like the Jewish part of Lansberg.
Like, when most people are not Bali Amadios or Bali Iska, they're just people who are various services.
Yes.
Because they're teachers and doctors and lawyers and things like that.
The United States generally is a service economy.
Oh, I guess what I
mean. Right? So that's all, right? So there are things that are true economically of production economies that are not true of service economies. Or the things there's a machloket about, right? Whether they're true or not true, let alone dot-coms. Whether dot-coms really changed the world, right? Internet commerce. And, figure, the U.S. regulation hasn't caught up to internet commerce yet. In Halacha, we're still trying to figure out, whether you can keep your website up on Shabbos. That's our big issue. Which is a really big issue, but until we solve it, there ain't nothing else going on. Okay, yes, Chet.
Like, Ziering actually mentioned this in 2012, but it's this idea of, there are different communities, and, a dollar, question is, if a dollar enters that community, how long is it until that dollar leaves that community? So, apparently this is, Nielsen did some study on this, a dollar, they're saying that, they're trying to answer a question of, if African Americans have so much capital, why isn't it being used effectively? And they're saying, a dollar circulates in the African American community for 6 hours and stays within the Asian community for a month. So it's 120 times longer.
Well, that's interesting. And there's no,
that's supposed to be some kind of proxy for how things are going. And then it says, instead in Jewish communities, it circulates for 20 days, and in white communities for 17 days.
Yeah, that's interesting. Certainly, when I grew up in Breuers, the community was thought to have an interest in shopping at the local Jewish-owned grocery store, even though they could not compete on price. And that's Hugh Garden Hill's the same phenomenon, where people are urged to. Question we have, equity interest, is kashrut, whether you accept the whether you have different hashgacha standards for Shomer Shabbat, non-Shomer Shabbat businesses. Right? Do you say that by Shomer Shabbat businesses, we fundamentally trust the owner, and so we only bring in Mashgiach occasionally, but for non-Shomer Shabbat owners, that will create a significant cost advantage for the Shomer Shabbat business. Is that a lack of, because it has to pay less for Hashgacha? So do we say, oh good, or do we say that's inequitable and we can't do that because we see ourselves, we're setting ourselves up to serve the whole community, and it's not fair if we create an economic advantage.
Do we want to create jobs for Mashgiach?
There's also that, right? If you read the history, you read the Kashrus book by, what's his name, from Albany, you'll see he has the quotes for you that when the original founder of the OU was indiscreet about that his goal was to, in large measure, was to create employment for graduates of Yeshivot. That was indiscreet.
Look, then you're leaving yourself open to, like, Shomer Shabbos businesses being lax in their kashrus.
Only if you don't trust them. Why would they be lax? They're Shomer Shabbos.
Right, that's why there's Haimisha Hashgacha.
Right, that's why, again, so see, our Hashgacha, largely my fault, has taken the position that when we have a certificate up, the certificate means we are supervising the kashrut, not we are certifying that someone's always from. And that was my argument. If that right, if really what giving hashgacha means that we're trusting the owner, we should put up the biggest sign saying, we, the Vlad Rabbani of Massachusetts, certify that the owner of this store is Shomer Shabbat, and therefore you can trust him. We have done nothing else. We will advise him when he asks. Now that is what the Haredi hashgachos will often do, and so that makes that so. It, right, so we price ourselves out of the market for Shomer Shabbat people, because why should they? That's a really serious challenge, I fought for that, and I was probably wrong as a practical matter. I thought I was right as an ethical matter, but I don't know that I was right as a practical matter. One of the many chumras of unorthodoxy that someone should be collecting. We move on to Baruch HaSfardi, about whom I everything I do if you read the Bar Ilan biography. that I included on top. So the things I wanted to put on him were, A, just that he has this interesting line, right, which he frames on the Mishnah about whether you can compete by circulating, by handing out candies, which is an interesting place to put it. He says, "Hine asur lachtoch michyat acherim." Right, so he uses the language of asur, and he doesn't. And so the question is, does lachtoch mean to cut off completely? Hard to, if he's really interpreting that right, that there's no cutting off work, stuff completely. But circulating candies doesn't cut the other person's livelihood off completely. So it sounds like you can't chop even a slice off. So, and yes, so,
I thought it was like lachtoch in like.
So you're not allowed to.
You're not allowed to give out food to other people.
Chotech chayim kol chay means distribute.
Isn't it?
I don't think that means distribute.
Maybe like the word.
That was to measure.
Word what?
Oh no, we read it as distribute also.
Like you can't
give
examples from the store?
No.
Lachtoch michyad acherim, I assume, means to cut off.
The word clean and, like, the thought.
Yeah, we said cut into.
Bring things
cut into.
Yeah, so it doesn't have any, it could mean completely, it could mean not completely. It's not clear.
Okay, but you can't translate lachtoch as to cut into.
Lachtoch me, sorry, lachtoch me.
Lachtoch michyad acherim, so it's a michyad acherim. Interesting.
Yeah,
I thought it was lachtoch michyad acherim.
To cut
interesting.
To cut from.
Interesting.
Cut into, yeah.
Interesting. We don't have dots. Tough to know. Someone else in a hand up? Elliot, you in a hand up?
No.
How
are you translating it? Clapper, how are you translating it?
To cut off someone else's livelihood.
And how is Torah translating? Cut into?
To cut from.
How?
Right, the question is whether it's michyat or mechayat.
What's the case of cutting into versus cutting out of?
You only diminish their income as opposed to. Make estimates that are supposed to drive them bankrupt. Yes, Elliot.
Yeah, I guess in general, when we have these types of rishonim,
most of us have never heard of them. It doesn't seem like a lot of people had them. Like, how much weight or validity do we give them philosophically?
That is a great question. I don't know. Yeah, I guess this is a chance to do my my riff on the Mayuri.
Riff?
R-I-F-F. On the Mayuri, you know, we're in Yeshiva, they always told us the Mayuri vanished. Only one copy of the Vatican, somebody sneaks in once a year and memorizes it.
Yeah, we're about to use it. That's how they tell sometimes.
Not true.
Look at the Dictuque Sophrium was done, like, mostly from memory. It's such an incredible
Eerie. So first of all, it's quoted in the Shita, that's right, which in a number of places Ramah has. But the Birka Yosef already has numbers of Masefta. If you look in the Harvard catalog, you see that they start printing it in the first volume of the 18th century. So people always erase, so it's just not true that Eerie vanished. What did vanish was the Ritva. So I'm always amused that people say, well, you can't do these new Rishonim like the Meiri, who was there all along, but the Ritva, everyone buys the Masada Rav Kook Ritva, which exists in many ways. But the Ritva, really, who had a Ritva?
I think
it's
the Ritva in one place that I've seen so far.
Pardon?
So I think you also had a Ritva in one place.
One place? Is he directly, or is he signing it with somebody else?
It looks like he's signing it directly.
Interesting. One place?
I've not seen that much, but you'll
okay.
The Rashba is like
the
unsung hero of Beit Yosef.
Okay, the Meiri happened to say controversial things about Christians, and so we built up this legend of the Meiri with Meiri vanished.
Well, about everything, really. He quotes all the Shitas, some
he also resurrects Provence. Right. But that's not, the Meiri is only controversial because of the Christian tale. Others would say, oh look, we found a Rishon, yay. We recovered Provence. If we recover the Ravid, do we not think the Ravid plays... Yeah, it plays a role. We didn't have his books, so...
We have to unbeat him.
But David Baruch is 40,
so it depends. You know, I think we have to go find out who Rav Baruch Hasfardi was. Right? And if it turns out that he's some anonymous yeshiva guy who everyone who really was the Frisco kid. It was like the bottom guy in the class, right? Who took the bad notes and it survived, right? And it survived back to them. That'd be bad if it turns out, so you look and see, like, was he on a bezdin that people respected, other people? I think that's the only way you can do it. There are cases where the bad note taker survived. I think there's a thing with somebody's biography of Washington far and away more copies survive of that book than any other book from the early 19th century. And somebody's biography of Washington. And the reason is that it's this big coffee table book that no one ever read, so all the copies are still pristine. Every copy ever printed, they still survive because they look pretty, and no one ever read them. Does that make it the most influential book of the... maybe that's how some of these people survive. I tend to be... Lichtenstein spent a lot of time, trying to parse this because the Shir was all built on Rishonim, who had not really been part of the mainstream, and trying to figure out.
Exotic Rishonim.
Right, what that would do the halacha. Inevitably, over time, by the second or third generation of people when they've already become part of your standard learning, it's much harder to keep them out of the system. And I am the third generation, right, of Lichtenstein or Rosenzweig, and then me. So I'm much more inclined to think of them as part of them. Like, why would anyone think that the Ravia wasn't part of the standard of Masoret, let alone the Tosas written the Urayim, right, which are vital for learning any sugya. Sorry, Rosenzweig's Shir is always set up.
It's okay, don't bother.
It's worth doing. Rosenzweig's Shir is set up always that the way he sets it up is he begins by setting out the extreme positions, and then the next several months are just trying to find precise positions between the extremes. And the extreme positions are always pretty much the Urayim on one end and the Tosas Rid on the other. Even though basically no one had ever used them in Shir before.
Because they're extreme.
Right, so if you're doing Shmaita, leave it to Hilchasav, you're just trying to learn Halacha. So why would you write, so you knew that we weren't going to Paskin like them. Right, because they're the extremists. But if you're giving a Shir, which is modified on that, so he brought them back into the mainstream by making them central. Or Rav Chaim or Zeruah.
Yeah, and Rav Lichtenstein loves the Rav.
Yeah, so there's a whole set of Rishonim who became standard in Gush that nobody learned in Yeshiva previously.
Or the Balanter.
This is great, and I'm gonna go. We're gonna go on knowing, thinking that what you do is totally 100% standard.
Yes. Right, there we are. And when I walked in as a sophomore at Rosen, I was like, sure. And all of a sudden, we had this wild thing where we spent the first month doing nothing but Sifrei HaMitzvot. You know, we're doing the Sefer HaMitzvot of the Rambam and the Chinuch and the Ireim and the Smog and all those sort of things. Like, whatever.
And the Griff.
We learn these things in like Haredi Shivas, though. Is that because of Aaron Lichtenstein?
Some of these things, you.
Like,
Ireim?
Yeah, in Chaim Berlin we learned it.
Ram of Chaim Berlin? I didn't know they were listening also in Chaim Berlin. Maybe you got it from there. I don't know. we touched on them. But also part of it is just to get printed again.
When was the Ritva printed?
So Dr. Soloveitchik in the Lost Test Bit for his father says the Rav got a Ritva somewhere in the early 40s, I think.
What is this?
Who does?
Mishnah Berurah.
There were Ritvas printed earlier, but the Rav didn't get one until.
Well, usually when the Ritva is quoted, it's from everything he writes on, or in Nedarim and Bechoros. He writes on the side of the Ritva and the Akapim Sephos.
So that may also be it. I think the Ritva was more lost than the Neri. I think that people had the Neri all along. And not everyone had a Ritva. I'm not a big fan. I think that, but I think obviously that that if you haven't been cited in a long time, so part of the nature of halacha is that you have a winnowing process, and so if you haven't gone through the winnowing process, I thought the Rav's line supposedly about Meiri that he was the world's greatest Achron, meaning that what he meant was that the Rishonim get winnowed, right? So the exotic positions of the Rishonim either got reinterpreted, or everyone knows that's Nitka Shlo Kilpasa, and all of a sudden a new Rishon shows up. It's not a fair playing field. Because now every position of this Rishon, right, is competing with the winnowed positions of the other Rishon, I mean, you should say. Right? So you can't treat him as on an equal level. You have to, right, it has to go through a winning process too. Right? So that was, right, so I've argued that the Meiri has to be treated as an Achron because he's gone through the same vetting process as the Chazon Ish. Right? And not through the same vetting process as the, let's say, Tosfos. So my point is also, but it's, we're not consistent about that. We should say the same thing about all the newly discovered rituals.
I think that we should have more like March Madness.
Yes.
But if it's a matter of personality, then if we found new stuff from Ramban, then we should treat it like a Rishon.
So I think that's the balance.
We know the Ramban. We know who's going on.
Right. So I think that's the balance. Some of it is built on authority by personality, but some of it is built on.
We knew who the Chazon Ish was.
Yeah. I think that's
the way that we don't know who the Meiri was.
We know a lot about the Meiri.
We know he was awesome.
We know a lot about the Meiri. You can figure it out. I think in some ways Meiri was in. Meiri's sort of like Rod Steinsaltz.
Which
is a really cool thing.
If he's Steinsaltz, what does that mean?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question, right? Meiri wrote an almost modern Hebrew summary of the Gemara, quoting lots and lots of different positions and synthesizing them. Right. That's a really impressive accomplishment. Do you have to be, where does that rank you in the scholars of the day? Right. That's an interesting question.
I don't even know where Steinsaltz is.
I agree. That's what I say. I don't know which way the comparison cuts. Okay. The other thing I wanted to point out on Berachas Friday, which we'll show up more later, is that despite all the argument we had yesterday, we said, hey, how could you possibly claim that these brides that are talking about issues of noise? Isn't it obvious in the flow of the Gemara that they're talking about competition? Rav Aruch's party says, "Hey, you know what? Maybe they're talking about noise, right? Perish, mishum tam de masnisim, the yomru lo nuchal lishon."
Does he think that solves something?
I have no idea, but we'll get to it later. Right? We'll see something later who takes this much, much further. Okay. Then Chantosas read. There were some things I couldn't that I had trouble. Just reading, truthfully.
Okay.
But the thing that mattered to me, right, or I think understanding what he's really saying, but what seemed to be the most important takeaway from the Tosfos Rid is that in all the geographic distinctions we made, so he introduced a new axis, right? We distinguish between the location of the competitor and the location of the competition. This is kind of the inverse of what the Nunuk Yosef did with the word L'Akvuye. Right, so he says that, right, for example, earlier on he says that if the guy pays the same tax rate, so we said you can keep out a competitor who's outside your musa, but not if he pays the same karga. And now he says, you know what? But even if he pays the same karga, he still can't come into your mavoy. He can only go b'kseh ha'ir, the mavoy acher. He can go somewhere else in the city. And then at the bottom he says, What's the suffix of the Rav Yosef? Uvar mavo achrina shu ben iro mesafkele im yachol dikvoa chanuto bitzido kevan shu ben iro v'dina kevar mavo adinafshe ol im yachol omar lo al taaseh benvoa didi avod benvoa didach. Right, so I think he keeps on focusing on the location of where the competing business will be, and not so much on where the competitor is from, and can work it out in detail on some other point. Okay, Yad Ramah. So the Yad Ramah begins by just with a fun for, we're going to go through the boldings in order. So the first thing he says, right, he adds, you say what you could say, Shu Yachol Omar Atoseh V'Tol Shali V'Ani Yoseh V'Tol Shali. And now he says, "Umayishna dechishat lechiyuta didach, velochishat lechiyuta didi." So he has a whole new question, right? The paskei le lechiyute, right? So why does your life have priority over mine? And we could have fun comparing this to the whole question. That on the one hand, you all know that it's yaharig val yavor to kill somebody else to save you. But you also know that we have a pasuk which says Chayech Hakod Bin L'Chayech Hicha, as Rabbi Akiva says, you can drink the water first. So lots of fun trying to figure that out. So he just puts this in the same context. Right. Who says that your livelihood comes before mine? Right. Then he has an interesting claim that you don't care about noise in a mavoy. Right. So let's read that line. Imishum riboy derech. Leka lamechash, the riboy derech ki haygavden b'mavoy lav riboy derechu. This kind of additional traffic doesn't count as traffic. Kevan de itle base of b'mavoy zachale bechol riboy derech de asi machmate v'afilu lagvuye bechanut the derech mavoy lekvoa bechanut. So he just has this claim, right? That there's certain, you can't make traffic claims about a mavoy against a member of the mavoy because that's part of your rights as a mavoy. Right? This is more along the language Tovah was reciting. Was claiming earlier, right? He says, you know what, there are certain rights that come with being a member of Mavoy, and one of them is you can generate unlimited traffic commercially. So don't make that claim. So then he introduces a whole new phenomenon. He says, if we read the Breita that we use to challenge Rav Huna, it uses the wrong language, right? Tuchi tema mi matis amart how can you claim that the Braisa of the Rabbanan of Shimon Gamliel, which we use ultimately to claim Rav Huna holds like Rav Shimon Gamliel, and Rav Huna holds against the Rabbanan, how can you claim that the whole logic of the Machloke between Rav Yehuda and Rav Shimon Gamliel, between the Chacham and Rav Shimon Gamliel, is about competition, Psuke Chiyuta, im kain, echi pasik v'tani, v'lo echad mi balei umliot. So if you read the Braisa says, that you can compel each other not to put a Baal Umaniyut in your chatzer. But, he says, if the issue is competition, right, it's not a question of whether you can introduce a workman, it's whether you introduce a workman who has the same business as you. So when we read it first, right, we assumed that was implicit. L'achadni Baal Umaniyut meant that you can prevent somebody from putting in any craftsman who has the same business as you, but Yad Ramah does not read it that way. Yad Ramah says it really means any craftsman, and if it means any craftsman, that means even craftsmen are not competing with you, and that must mean that the logic here has nothing to do. The Breita itself does not address competition. The Breita addresses noise. And then he has to go through massive contortions to claim right, to claim that even though the Braisa is talking about noise, it has implications for competition. Right, and then at the end of that, right, having gone through all his contortions to try and accomplish this, he says, "Hang on a sec, but I recognize I just went through all these contortions. Why did I? Right, I need all these contortions to get Rafuna in trouble. Why don't I just not go through those contortions and say Rafuna's delivery a call?" And his answer is, "Well, then we would be stuck with the contradiction between Braito, which, not really convincing at all." Yes, it's Ramacho.
I mean, because we have what we really be stuck with is Rafuna agreeing with this, with the second Braisa, and then this other Braisa that explicitly is against Rafuna, and that would create a Machlokas, which we don't like because we'd like to have at least one named position when we have a Machlokas.
So we have two anonymous Braisa contradicting each other?
Yeah.
So which is the anonymous Braisa that supports Rafuna?
The anonymous Braisa, the Braisa with Ramesh Galil would support Rafuna, and then we would have the one that was quoted before, that was the Kashi that we had to respond with Tanayahi for.
But the